This is Audible.
Dreamscape presents Unfaithful by Natalie Borelli. Narrated by Emily Rankin. Chapter 1. I wake up too early, too hot, my legs entangled in the sheet. I dreamt of something stressful. Something to do with missing a flight or losing my passport. Then there was a ladder that didn't quite get up to a top floor and was swaying dangerously. It's the phone ringing that pulls me out of the dream. I reach for it quickly so as not to wake Lewis, my pulse still racing. Hello?
It's me.
I raise myself on one elbow.
Alex, what time is it?
I don't know, 5? 6? I need to see you.
Beside me, Lewis stirs.
I'll have to call you back.
When can you come?
He has that urgent tone, the way he speaks when he wants my attention, immediately. It's not even 6 in the morning, and I'm exhausted already.
I don't know, Alex. I have a meeting this morning. I'll come after.
No, you have to come now.
Alex, I can't. I'll come later, as soon as I'm free, all right? What's going on, anyway?
He sighs into the phone. Or maybe he's smoking. He says he doesn't, but I've smelt it on him often enough. Dope, mostly.
I'll tell you when you get here. Bring the notebooks with you.
All of them?
Yes. It's important, Anna. Bring them, okay?
He hangs up. I turn to look at Lewis, who is sleeping beside me. One arm flung above his head, calm as smiling Buddha. I bet he's not dreaming of swaying ladders and missed flights. I kiss his bare shoulder, and he doesn't even stir. Nothing can wake up Lewis, except Lewis.
Who was that?
He croaks.
Sorry, I was hoping you were still asleep.
That was Alex.
Of course it was. Can you ask your students not to call in the middle of the night, please?
He turns on his side and I push playfully against his back.
It's not the middle of the night, it's 6 a.m.
I can hear the birds outside, and there's a sliver of dawn light slipping around the edge of the blinds.
I was up late,
he mumbles.
I know.
I rub my face with both hands.
I may as well get up.
You want me to bring you a cup of coffee?
No, thank you.
Downstairs, Roxy greets me by dropping a chewed-up toy at my feet. We go through our usual routine where I stroke her head and she rolls on her back, exposing her pink belly for me to scratch. She's a French bulldog, and technically she's Mateo's dog. I let her out the back door and into the yard, then turn on the coffee machine. While I wait for it to warm up, I empty the dishwasher, change the water in Roxy's bowl, open a bag of dog food, and scoop some into her food bowl. All the time, I am thinking about Alex, analyzing how he sounded just now, what it might mean. Alex is my best, brightest PhD student. He's a genius, really. I've never had a student like him before. He's on the cusp of publishing something extraordinary. And my job with him is to make sure he gets there in one piece. Sipping my coffee, I open my laptop to go over my notes. First thing this morning is a faculty meeting. We're facing an uncertain future, and I suggested to Jeff about getting together a fundraising committee weeks ago. I did it to make a good impression, to show that I'm a team player and full of good ideas. Jeff agreed to my suggestion. He almost always does. Jeff is the chair of the mathematics department, and what Jeff thinks matters. Especially as any day now I will find out if my full professorship application has been successful. I am pretty confident, or I'm trying to be anyway. Part of me feels that if I don't get it after all the extra work I've been doing, I may as well give up. Those of us who applied in the department expected to have heard by now. But this year there's only one full-time position because of our budget cuts, and it's taken longer than usual. Nail-bitingly longer, you could say, but still, I'm cautiously optimistic. I go back upstairs to shower and get dressed into my usual meeting attire, linen skirt and pearl-colored blouse. Professional, but feminine. I clip on a pair of small diamond earrings. Not real diamonds. We do all right, but we're not that rich. And fasten a silver necklace with a small heart-shaped pendant around my neck. A gift from the children for Mother's Day. In the mirror, I catch Louis watching me from the bed, one arm bent behind his head. He's frowning. What's wrong? I ask.
You look conservative, like a schoolteacher.
I am a schoolteacher.
You know what I mean.
I smile and reach for my lipstick, desert rose, and stare back at my reflection. My mother's voice pops into my head, unbidden.
Look your best to do your best.
I close my eyes. Why did I have to think of my mother now? Now she's going to be like an elephant around my neck all day. Or is it an albatross? Whatever. A big, cumbersome weight dragging me down, making me feel inadequate, reminding me that I'm not quite living up to my potential. Unless I don't let her. Easier said than done, I think, as I run a brush through my hair.
Where are you off to anyway?
Louis asks. Faculty meeting, remember?
Oh, yeah, he says.
But I know he doesn't. I pick up the bottle of perfume he bought me for my birthday, Lancôme's La Vie Belle, and I spray a cloud at the base of my throat. Jeff at work commented on the scent once.
Is it you who smells so delish?
Delish. It seemed so suggestive. Sometimes I think if I were willing, which I'm not at all, but if I were, I used to think he was kind of handsome for an academic, with his dark gray messy curly hair swept back and reaching down his neck. He wears glasses, thin-rimmed ones, and has a graying beard that makes him look like Neil Gaiman. Louis rubs his knuckles over his head and throws off the covers.
Why don't you stay in bed?
I say.
That's okay.
He yawns.
I'm awake now. I'll be in the shower.
On the way downstairs, I pass by Mateo's room. He's still fast asleep, his Batman-themed comforter thrown onto the floor, his arms and legs spread out like a starfish. I turn on the light, kiss his hair. Come on, Maddie, time to get up, honey. He stirs, yawns, and his eyes pop open. I pick a sweatshirt up off the floor and put it on the back of his chair, then tell him to get ready and make sure to pack his gym bag. In Carla's room, I find her at her desk doing some last-minute revision. Morning, you. Did you sleep well? I ask, kissing the top of her head.
Yes, thanks.
She barely moves, one elbow on the desk, her head propped up on her hand. I kiss her again, smell her long, soft hair. At 13, she's as tall as me already.
Come and have breakfast.
She nods, mumbles that she'll be down in a minute. In the kitchen, I'm preparing school lunches for my children when they bounce in arguing, jostling each other at the fridge, for the milk, over the box of cereal. They work around me, all of us anticipating each other's movements. Cupboard doors fly open and sometimes get closed again. Bowls are dropped on the kitchen table with a clatter and are filled with cereal and milk, fruit and yogurt. I try to keep up, put things away as needed, scolding them half-heartedly for making a mess, but secretly loving how noisy they are, the chaos they create, and the sense that I'm at the center of it, bringing order to their lives. Louis joins us, dressed in jeans and a white shirt, his hair still damp from the shower. He grabs a yogurt from the refrigerator and slowly spoons it into his mouth, leaning against the kitchen counter. Mateo has gone back upstairs and shouts down that he has lost a sneaker and it's really bad because he has soccer practice today. I go up to his room and locate the shoe under his bed along with a bevy of dirty socks and underpants. I add them to a load of washing and turn the machine on. Will you please fix the tap today? I ask Louis. Every day I bring up the dripping tap in the kitchen, and every day Louis says he'll fix it. Every day I say something like, "If you don't have time, I can get the plumber in." And every day he assures me that's a waste of money and he'll do it himself. Today is no exception.
"And since you're up early, would you walk Roxy, please?"
He drops the yogurt container in the trash can and kisses the top of my head.
"Sorry, I have to get back to the gallery. I'm under the gun."
I put my hands on his chest. "I know, I remember." Lewis's upcoming exhibition is a very big deal. He's been stressed about it for months, and my job is to support him when he's like that. It's my favorite job, actually, looking after my family. I run my hand through his dark hair, still as thick as ever and always falling over his forehead. Whenever I picture Lewis in my mind's eye, it's with one hand pushing back a lock of hair between his thumb and forefinger.
"You'll be fine. Do what you have to," I say.
Carla reappears, dressed and ready for school. "Will you put the washing out on the line when you get home?" I ask her.
"Why can't Maddie do it?"
"Because he's got soccer practice and you'll be home way before him."
"Okay."
Lewis hugs the kids, kisses me goodbye. I remind him to pick up Maddie from soccer practice this afternoon.
"And please don't be late," I plead.
Mateo gets very anxious when people are late. One time, Lewis and I had a misunderstanding about who was where when, and no one picked up Maddie. He sat on a bench at a bus stop and waited for 26 minutes. That's what he said, 26 minutes, repeatedly. And by the time I got there, he had wet himself. It took over an hour to console him. Lewis and I had a huge fight afterwards about who was supposed to pick him up, and we never agreed on it. Although to this day, I know it was supposed to be Lewis.
"And don't forget tonight."
"What about tonight?" he says.
"Ha ha, you're so funny, you should have been on the stage."
"I tried. They wouldn't even let me audition." I laugh. It's an accidental joke because tonight the kids are putting on a show. Carla has written a play for the Young Playwrights Competition, and she is staging a special preview performance for us, having roped in her little brother to play various roles, all in our very own living room. I think I'm as excited as they are.
"Do I need to get anything for dinner?" Lewis asks.
"No, all done."
It's pizza night tonight. One day when my children are old enough to go to restaurants by themselves, they will realize that real pizza tastes like heaven, drips with oily, melted cheese, has very few vegetables on it, and miles of pepperoni. Pizza here, Chez Sanchez, consists of homemade whole grain sourdough spread with homemade low-salt tomato passata, truckloads of seasonal vegetables, and low-fat cottage cheese. Sometimes I wonder how much of what I do to look after my family will end up as a discussion on a therapist's couch. Lewis gives me that lovely smile of his that still makes my heart flutter. Then, with another kiss, he's gone. I hug my children goodbye, tell them I love them to bits, accidentally mess up Carla's hair.
"Mom!"
And, after they're gone, I grab the leash and the roll of dog poop bags from the hook behind the door of the laundry and let Roxy out for a quick walk around the block. Chapter 2.
"Good morning, everyone." Jeff is standing at the whiteboard. We don't use screens or projectors for small meetings like this, just good old-fashioned magnetic boards. He shoots me an annoyed look over his shoulder.
"Hey, there you are," he says.
"Yeah, sorry. Dog walking. Lost track of time." There are five of us in this committee. Jeff, of course, as the department chair, and the other two mathematics professors, Rohan and John. Then there's Mila, the youngest in the faculty, as she likes to remind everyone on a regular basis, and me. We're here because our future funding is tenuous at best. Our generous endowment has been frittered away by our so-called investment advisors who managed to get a return at about a third the rate of everyone else, and now we have to come up with new sources of income. That, in a nutshell, is the meeting. I nod at each of them and set my laptop on the table.
"So, where are we up to?"
I wake up the laptop and open a new document while surreptitiously checking out Mila. She's wearing a loose top that droops over her bare shoulder in a "can't keep it up, it's too big" sort of way, revealing a thin silver bra strap. At least she's wearing a bra over a fine collarbone. I look down at her skinny jeans, fashionably torn at the knees and cut off above her delicate ankles. I don't know. She's obviously smart. After all, she's an associate professor at 26. But she's also very pretty, with shiny black hair and olive skin, and eyelashes so long I suspect they're false. Being sexy shouldn't be a disadvantage in this job, but I think it is. I'd never dress like that for a business meeting. What was it Lewis said this morning? You look conservative. I catch Mila looking at me, looking at her, and I quickly return to my laptop, my finger poised over the keyboard. Since you're here, will you take minutes, Anna? Sure, happy to. I always take minutes. I may as well have it tattooed on my forehead. Team player, no job too small or too menial. Then Jeff adds, I know I always ask you, but you're the only one I can trust to do it right. I smile. Then I think I'm blushing. Am I blushing? I sure hope not. It's no problem, I stress. Of course, it's not really my job to take minutes. He could have asked June, the department secretary, to sit in. But the truth is, I am the only one who can be trusted to do it right. That's one thing everyone always says about me. I am dependable. I will always step in and help, and often make things right. Which is probably why I'm always in meetings. When I'm not teaching, I mean. I seem to always put my hand up for things. Committees, student support, fundraising, grant applications, acquittals. Sometimes I end up on committees I don't remember signing up for. But if the work needs to be done, I am ready. I rally when the going gets tough. I'm a rallier. Ideas, Jeff says now. Let's hear them. Anyone? At the top of my document, I type new funding opportunities, staff suggestions, and bold it. Mila takes the pencil she's chewing out of her mouth.
We could contact our alumni, organize a fundraising dinner.
Good. Thank you, Mila. Jeff writes down Mila's suggestion on the board, like it's a very valid one, and I'm thinking, really? Is that the best you can do? Then he says, Anna, will you organize it? I blink. I'm about to say, why doesn't Mila organize it? It's her idea. But being a team player, a rallier, I just nod. Although I do ask, don't we do that already? No, we don't. So let's.
Okay.
Anyway, as a member of the teaching staff, I don't think he actually means for me to organize it. I make a note to mention it to June. Let's not beat around the bush here, people, Jeff continues. This faculty will not get bailed out again by the executive. At this rate, we'll be lucky if we make it to the end of next year. We are in early talks with a number of philanthropic institutions. June and I are handling that. But I'll be blunt, it doesn't look good. So if you have any bright ideas, what's going on, Anna?
I look up.
Nothing, why? You're smiling.
I plaster on my most innocent face.
Puzzled, sincere. If I could, I wouldn't just say it out loud, I would scream it from the top of my lungs. Because when I suggested this committee, I didn't know that Alex, my PhD student, was about to prove one of mathematics' most important conjectures. And once Alex and I publish our paper, donors will be falling over themselves to throw money at us. That's how important this paper is. It's groundbreaking and marvelous, and it's the best thing to come out of Locke Wideman University ever. And while it's absolutely Alex's work, as Alex's advisor, I can say I am responsible, in my own small way, for that achievement.
I imagine Jeff's face when he finds out that I am co-author of a groundbreaking paper that is going to bring Googleplexes of dollars to our university. I mean, let's face it. The last time I published anything was a comment on a working mom's Facebook group about a one-pot recipe. My whole family loved it. 5 stars. I shake my head. Nope, all good, as you were. He winks at me and turns back to the board. Okay, then. Alex had come to study at this little university because of me, he said. He had stumbled upon a paper I had published a million years ago, back when I was a grad student myself, and had walked into my office brandishing a copy of a now-defunct mathematics journal. He wanted me to supervise his thesis, which, at the time, was on theta and zeta functions. He'd had offers from other universities, some certainly more prestigious than ours, but I must do it here, with you, he'd argued. My first impression, from the way he looked and the way he spoke, was that he would have been more at home at Princeton than at our humble institution. He's athletic, very handsome, with fair hair, and when he smiles, which isn't that often anymore, I always find myself staring at his teeth, so perfect, so white. Was I flattered that very first day? Absolutely. Did I want the extra work? No. But he wore me down with his big, pleading blue eyes and his earnest face. Please, Dr. Sanchez, you're the only one that I want. I'd laughed, and he smiled in that seductive way of his, all teeth and charm, like he already knew he'd won. And he had, I guess, because I said yes, because he did spike my interest, and because it is nice to be wanted. It was immediately obvious that he was bright. I mean, really bright. But like a lot of geniuses, he's also obsessive. He can spend days poring over a minute and insignificant detail. It's as if he can't differentiate what's important from the trivial. He also gets distracted easily. After he'd been working on his chosen topic for a few weeks, he came to my office, closed the door, sat down and said, I have to tell you something. We didn't have a meeting scheduled, but that never bothered Alex. He just comes in whenever he likes, and if I'm sitting with another student, he'll wait outside, tap his foot against the door jamb loud enough for us to hear, cough, make a nuisance of himself until we're done, or until we give up. What is it? I asked. You have to promise to keep it secret. I rubbed my forehead. I can't promise that. What have you done? He looked sideways and sighed. Did you get drunk? Do something you regret? Did anyone get hurt? Do we need to speak to student services? Anna, are you for real? Is that the first thing that comes into your mind? Just tell me, Alex. He handed me an ordinary spiral notebook. Alex does all his preliminary work on paper, which is not that unusual. I opened it. The writing was messy, full of crossed-out equations and shorthand notes, but I knew how to read it, and it made my stomach twist. I stared at it for a long time, and for a moment I wondered if he was playing a joke on me. Can you tell what this is? He said. I couldn't even look at him. And I couldn't speak either. The Penty Stone conjecture. A famous problem, unsolved, first proposed in 1905 by mother and daughter mathematicians Claudia Penty and Noemi Stone. Then the world forgot about them until an American billionaire and futurist called Leo Forrester resurrected them. His foundation awards prizes to innovative discoveries. And he'd stumbled upon the Penty Stone and realized that if it were solved, it would revolutionize too many things to list, from computing power to aircraft design. The reason I knew so much about the Penty Stone was because of my mother. She was a scientist, and I was an only child who turned out to be a bit of a math prodigy,
an aptitude I nurtured and generally worked very hard at because it felt like it was the only thing she liked about me. If I had to describe my mother, I would say she was cool, strict to the point of austere, and not very motherly. When I was 14 years old, my mother assigned the Penty Stone problem to me as some kind of punishment for sneaking out one night and going to a party I hadn't been allowed to go to. That summer, when my friends were hanging out by the river, going to the mall, having sleepovers, I was at my little desk trying to solve a math problem that had grown men punching the wall in frustration. But that was the deal, she'd said. If I could solve it, I could go out and play. I didn't know it was some kind of trick, and I spent the entire summer on it, poring over equations just like the ones I was staring at in Alex's notebook, until my eyes felt like I'd rubbed salt into them. I didn't solve it. That should go without saying. And to this day, the very name Penty Stone makes me want to bite someone. I flicked through Alex's notebook, numbers blurring as I swiped the pages quickly back and forth, unable to fully absorb what I was looking at, feeling confused by the familiar, the aberrant, knowing I should feel excited by the possibility but feeling devastated instead. Finally, I looked up. He was grinning, and I wanted him to go away. I wanted to say I had work to do, that I had no time for this. Then he said it. The Penty Stone conjecture. I think I have an angle. He looked nervous, almost frightened. Really? Yes. There's a prize, too. $500,000 to the first person to prove or disprove the Penty Stone. Not as much as Mathematics Millennium Prize, that's the big one, at $1 million, but not small change either. I stood up to close the door, even though the room felt airless. You want to talk me through it? He did, animatedly, chaotically, and yet beautifully. He hadn't come up with a complete solution yet, but the work he'd done on his thesis to date had accidentally nudged him in the right direction. I think I can do it, he said, breathless. I paused, willing my heart to slow down. It's harder than you think. I know. I need your help, Anna. Will you help me? Would I help him? My first thought was no. Absolutely not. But how could I say no? What if he found another supervisor? Someone at MIT, maybe? Could I bear it? And if I said yes, I could think of it as closing a circle. The end of the work I'd started so very long ago. And I want to change my PhD topic to this, he continued. Can I do that? I thought about it. The ramifications were negligible. People changed their topic all the time. And it has to remain secret, he added. For obvious reasons. Obviously. If it became known at this point, even just within the university, that Alex was close to solving the Penty Stone, and especially what his approach was, there was no doubt someone else would jump on it and quite possibly snatch the prize before he did. Us academics might look mild-mannered and geeky on the surface, but underneath we're a bunch of hyenas who'd do anything for a scrap of recognition. Not even your husband, he said. Honestly, Alex, Lewis wouldn't know the Penty Stone from the Rosetta Stone. I don't care. Nobody can know. You have to swear. Nobody. I did. I swore. I'm good at keeping secrets, I said. I was already thinking of what it might mean for the university, the research funding we'd be able to attract. This would be a game changer for our faculty. We would join the ranks of the most prestigious academic institutions in America. After that, the conjecture was all he could think about.
but passion has its consequences. He lost weight, lost sleep, grew dark circles under his eyes. We spent months on it, which is not very long in the scheme of things. People spend years, decades, trying to solve a conjecture. He went down rabbit holes a few times. He'd think he was so close, then one detail would make the whole thing crash and he'd have to start again. Then he became paranoid that people were spying on his work. He wouldn't put anything at all in a computer in case we got hacked. He wrote everything by hand and kept it in a locked drawer in my desk, even though he had his own locked cabinet in an office he shared with other students. "I don't trust them," he said. "So lock it in your cabinet, then. Anna, they're on wheels." In the end, we agreed he could work in my office, which I would lock whenever I was out. I also had a small desk brought in especially for him. It was kind of exhilarating because we made progress so quickly. But when his health deteriorated, when he couldn't cope with the pressure, he was awful to be around. I dreaded coming to work. He was always angry, sad, desperate, manic. Then he became resentful of me because he thought I wasn't doing enough to help him, as if somehow it was my fault he hadn't solved it yet. Like it was simple multiplication and I hadn't explained to him how to do it. Then he stopped coming altogether. I knew he wasn't working on it at home because all his notes were in my office. Then one night I woke up in the middle of a dream with an idea. I tiptoed downstairs and called him. I told him my theory. "What if? What do you think? Would that work?" 2 days later, he'd cracked it. A PhD thesis can only be authored by the student in question. But we agreed to write a paper together about the Penti Stone conjecture and its proof. We'd be co-authors, which was not that unusual between the student and his or her advisor, but to co-author a paper on such groundbreaking work is worth its weight in gold for any academic. His name would be first. There was no question about that. But we would have to be quick. Even though I wasn't paranoid like he was, ideas have been known to hop from head to head until they find a willing host. Often they find more than one, and whoever gets there first wins. Chapter 3.
"You look nice today," Jeff says. The others have gone, and it's just him and me left. He's packing up his laptop, and I'm tidying up the meeting room, making sure to leave it the way I'd like to find it.
"Do I?"
I give a little laugh, turning to wipe the whiteboard so I don't have to look at him. "That's nice. Lewis thought I looked conservative." He comes up right next to me and takes the block eraser from my hand, puts it down in the tray.
"What?"
I ask. He takes my shoulders so that I'm facing him, then reaches for the top of my shirt and swiftly undoes the button.
"There,"
he smiles.
"Fixed it."
I feel myself redden. The top edge of my plain white bra is visible now, and my first thought is, I wish I'd worn a nicer one. Jeff walks away, stops at the door.
"See you around,"
he says, with a wink. I finish tidying the room, a little embarrassed, a little shocked even, yet unable to suppress the small smile playing on my lips. Last year, when Jeff and I were away at some conference in Chicago, something almost happened between us. He'd been looking at me like a ravenous wolf all evening, and I was flattered, probably more than I should have been. Somehow, I ended up drinking too much, certainly more than I'd intended, and next thing I knew, we were in his room and he'd gone down to his boxer shorts. But I checked out at the last minute. It was as if I'd woken up from a dream, and an image of Carla and Mateo's cute little faces looking up at me popped into my mind. I excused myself and ran out of the room, and I thank my lucky stars every day that I came to my senses before anything actually happened. I was embarrassed the next day, my memory blurry from all the alcohol I'd consumed. I rushed to apologize, although for which part I'm not sure. The part where I almost went through with it, or the part where I didn't? He laughed.
Don't worry about it, Anna.
Then he made a show of checking no one was around before leaning forward and in a low voice he said, next time. And I laughed. I don't think so, I said, even though I was kind of flattered he still wanted to. He made a sad face and put both hands over his heart.
You're killing me.
I chuckled, lightly punched his shoulder. I was so grateful we could laugh about it. I shudder to think what might have happened, but now it's like a secret joke between us. One time, someone mentioned Chicago in a meeting, and we immediately looked at each other and cracked up behind our hands. I make a short detour to see June on the way back from the meeting so I can tell her about the alumni dinner. And I'll make sure to tell her that it was Mila's initiative, not mine. I don't want her to think I'm assigning extra work to her. I've almost reached her when Clyde, the associate dean of the college, slaps a sheaf of papers on her desk.
For Christ's sake, June, are you completely stupid? These are last year's figures. I asked for this year's intake. Can you get it right this time?
Then he turns around, mutters something about having to do everything twice around here, and marches back down the corridor. It was a shocking performance, and if I'd had time to turn away, I would have. But it's too late now. It would only add to June's embarrassment. So I stand there, inches from her desk, a smile plastered on my face like nothing's wrong, or if it is, I didn't notice. She reaches for the bundle with a trembling hand and pulls it slowly towards her. She looks like she's going to cry, with her head down and her black curls falling forward, almost hiding her face. He's a bully, I say simply. He speaks like that to me all the time. I don't know why I say that, since it's not true. I just want to soften her humiliation. I certainly don't think Clyde should speak to anyone like that, and I make a mental note to pull him up on it later. June looks up, crimson patches blooming on her cheeks. She tries to smile and fails. Her chin wobbles.
I doubt that very much.
You'd be surprised.
It's not even my job, she says.
His secretary is off sick, and I've been asked to step in.
I lean forward and whisper,
I searched his desk for a stapler once, and I found a penis enlargement pump, top left drawer, under that stupid little tray he keeps his paper clips and rubber bands in.
I stand up.
Just think about that next time he talks to you like that.
We both know I just made that up. She drops her head and laughs silently, and it takes a moment for her to recover.
When she looks up again, the smile is real.
Thank you,
she says, still trying and failing to stop grinning. I wink at her. My pleasure. I tell her about the alumni dinner proposition, then head back in my office and type up the minutes so they're ready to email before I leave to meet Alex. Then Mila comes in. There's a guffaw of student laughter outside, and she closes the door.
Anna, do you have a moment?
Of course, Mila. Please. I indicate the seat opposite. How can I help you? She looks skyward, like she's thinking about it. I wait, my hands knotted together, a benign smile on my face. I'm going for the mentor to mentee look, even though I'm wondering if she's going to ask me to do something. Pick up one of her tasks. Find someone to mark her exams. Organize the alumni dinner. How can I help? I repeat.
I wanted to tell you myself. Make sure you were okay.
Oh? She looks sideways, takes in a small, sharp breath, closes her eyes briefly, and I know now it's going to be bad. For me.
I got the professorship. I found out this morning.
I manage to stretch my lips thinly over my teeth
and into a smile. My knuckles have turned white, and I feel my chest rise and fall as my pulse races. I repeat the words in my head, in case I got them wrong the first time. I got the professorship. Nope, no change. Stomach still clenched. I'm trying to think of something to say, and we just stare at each other in silence for a while.
I didn't know you'd applied.
Yeah, it was on impulse, really. Just a last-minute thing. Jeff suggested it.
He did.
A last-minute thing? It takes weeks, months, to put an application like that together. Is she going to say she wrote the application 20 minutes before the deadline?
I don't get it. Does she want me to feel even worse?
Then it occurs to me maybe there's more than one professorship this year after all. Maybe I too will find out today.
So they announced it?
This morning. And Anna, let me say that I was completely surprised. Shocked, really. I was sure it would be you, and it should have been you. I don't know why they gave it to me. I keep expecting someone to tap me on the shoulder and say they've made a mistake.
She gives a small, self-deprecating laugh. There are probably things I should say, but I can't speak.
It's like my throat has clammed up and nothing will squeeze by except maybe my last breath. I know you must be disappointed.
She tilts her head at me, checking to see just how disappointed, presumably. Not at all, I manage, finally. I was going to say happy, but it gets caught.
Pleased for you. Really?
Of course. Why wouldn't I be? She puts a hand on top of her chest, just below her throat.
Oh, thank God. I was really hoping you'd say that, but I was a little bit nervous, especially since you were one of the people who interviewed me when I first started.
Yes, I remember.
You'd think the more senior person would get it first. I would have thought anyway, so I'm glad you're being so good about it.
There's a lone paperclip on my desk, and I see myself in my mind's eye straightening it out and shoving it in her cheek just to shut her up.
Don't be silly. It's fabulous. I couldn't be happier. Well deserved. Congratulations.
I get up because I'm starting to shake and I'm afraid she'll see it, which would only add to my humiliation. She gets to her feet.
Thank you for being so good about it,
she says again. I can't get to the women's toilets fast enough. I lock myself in a cubicle, close the seat, and sit down. I'm breathing too fast, too loud. I drop my head in my hands and time my breaths, wait for my pulse to slow down. I press my fingers against my eyes.
Of course I didn't get it. I haven't published anything in years. I just teach, work, sit on useless committees, and take minutes.
That's not a track to full professor. That's a track to full-blown idiot, moron, gopher, errand girl.
And what was it she said?
A last-minute thing. Jeff suggested it.
Why would he do that when he'd already suggested to me that I apply and there was only one position available?
Except he didn't suggest it, did he?
But he sure didn't stop me when I brought it up.
Quite the opposite, I would have thought, considering all the extra work I've been doing these last few months, which will make a good impression on the committee, Anna. They love a team player. At the sink, I splash water on my face and dab at my eyes. I recover myself enough to go back to my office, only for Jeff to stick his head round the door a moment later.
Ah, Anna, can I have a word?
Is this about Mila?
Because I think it's great, really great. Wonderful news.
Yes, good, so you know.
Yes. Couldn't be happier for her.
Okay. Good. Oh, by the way, did you type those minutes?
In your inbox.
Well done. Good stuff.
I want to go home and curl up in my bed, go to sleep for a year or two, but I can't because I have a class. Maybe I could say I'm sick,
Ask June to get a replacement teacher for the afternoon. One of the postdocs. No. Mila will know it's because of her. And then she'll think I'm upset and she'll be making cooey noises at me.
Oh, you are upset, Anna. I'm so, so sorry.
I wonder if Mila will offload some of her classes on me now.
Of course she will.
Then I remember I am supposed to go and see Alex. Good. This is what I need to focus on. Alex and the Penty Stone Conjecture. It sounds like a children's book title. Alex and the Penty Stone Conjecture. I blow my nose, picturing Jeff's face and Mila's when they find out our paper got published. I imagine Jeff realizing he backed the wrong applicant. Mila's words echo in my mind. It should have been you. Damn right it should. I think back to the phone call from Alex. What is he up to? He sounded upset? Not exactly. Intense? Yes, definitely. Should I brace myself for more bad news? Has he found an error? Will he say we can't submit yet? It would be a setback, certainly, but we'd had those before. Maybe this one is much more serious. But I know the work and I know the paper and I know it's ready. Unless I've missed something. And considering it was only this morning that I was quietly confident I'd find out any day now that I got the professorship, and I didn't even twig that Mila was in the running, let alone that she'd beat me to it. Maybe I shouldn't trust my own judgment. But I need this paper. This is my opportunity to prove them wrong, to laugh in their face, to quit the job and get a better one elsewhere. Maybe move the family to Boston so I could teach at MIT. I grab my bag and snatch my jacket from the back of my chair. I don't care what Alex's problem is right now. I'll sort it out. I don't care what it takes either. I just want to see the look on Mila's face when our paper gets published. I want to get to tap her on the shoulder and say, I think they did make a mistake after all, Mila. Chapter 4. I've been to Alex's apartment a few times before, and I park around the corner, turn off the ignition, and take a moment. I need to be calm and reassuring. Alex has a tendency to overreact, and God knows he can get himself into a state of despair over the smallest thing. He's 27 years old, but sometimes he may as well be 12. But he is the genius behind our work, and my future depends on how well I can manage him, as I remind myself as I make my way up the stairs. His apartment is very nice, certainly not what you'd expect a student to live in. It's roomy, with a big flat screen on one wall of the living room and beige, glass, and chrome furnishing that would look great in an office or a showroom. He shares it with another student who, from memory, is studying journalism. But Alex doesn't need the rent his roommate brings in. His parents are paying, and he joked once he'd only got someone to move in so he'd have someone to talk to. I knock, and he opens the door immediately, shirtless, his pupils dilated, and it occurs to me suddenly that he could be on something, some kind of amphetamines. By the looks of him, he must have been abusing them for a while, and I chide myself for not checking in with him sooner. "Where's your roommate?" I ask, taking my jacket off and laying it on the arm of the sofa. "What's his name again?"
"Vernon. He's out. Do you have the notebooks?"
"Oh, shit. Sorry.
Anna, did you forget?"
"Sorry, I did. Lots going on this morning." He breathes out loudly through his nose, but then seems to relax again.
"You want a coffee? I'm about to have one."
"Sure." He does a double take.
"You've been crying?"
"No."
"Your eyes are all puffy."
"I said no."
He shrugs and I follow him to the kitchen and watch him spoon ground coffee into the machine. I'm about to ask what the problem is when he blurts it out. "I've changed my mind."
I wait for the rest, but he's silent. Just keeps making the coffee and won't meet my eye as he fusses with the cups and the sugar bowl.
Okay. About what?
I'm already exhausted as I brace myself for his inevitable self-doubt, for the speech about how he thinks he has it wrong. The submission committee at the Journal of Applied Number Theory won't accept it if there is any doubt about the validity of the solution.
He knows that. And I have friends at MIT who could take a look now if he doesn't want to wait that long. They'd sign a confidentiality agreement. This kind of thing happens all the time. He knows that, too.
Talk to me, Alex. Don't you want to publish it yet? Is that it? He snaps his head around.
My thesis? Of course I'm publishing it. Are you nuts?
Okay, good to hear. So what are we talking about? He's smiling as he thinks about it. Then his features harden until his mouth is so taut that when he speaks again, he can barely move his lips.
You're not gonna like it.
Jesus. He looks really bad. When did I see him last? 2 weeks at least. He pulls out a letter from his back pocket and hands it to me. I hesitate, then take the envelope from him between two fingers, trying not to stare at his filthy fingernails.
What's this?
I'm about to pull out the single sheet of paper from it when he speaks.
I'm going to publish it alone. The thesis, of course, but also the research paper.
I'm sorry?
I don't want you to co-author it anymore.
I almost laugh.
This is a joke, right?
His hand shakes as he handles the coffee, and some of it spills onto the table. My first instinct is to grab a kitchen cloth and clean it up, but I don't.
I've thought long and hard about it, he says. It's mine.
A wave of outrage flares through me, and I grip the envelope tighter in my fist, but then tell myself to calm down. I take a breath and let it slip from my fingers. He doesn't mean it. He's panicking about something. There's no need for me to do the same. He leans against the window ledge, stirring his coffee with a spoon, a breeze from the partly open sash window behind him ruffling his hair.
Come on, Alex. I helped you. You know that. You couldn't have done it without me.
He smirks, rudely.
Are you listening to yourself? I did do it without you, Anna. You were there in the room, and that's about the extent of your contribution.
You know that's not true.
I think of all the hours I spent with him, poring over his work, trying to grab hold of the slimmest gossamer thread that we could tug and unspool into the light. I think of all the times he despaired and wanted me to hold him until it passed, the times he would sob on my shoulder like a child while I whispered soothing words to him. He told me once that I was much nicer than his own mother. Thinking back on it in this moment, I realize something I didn't want to confront then, but I may have to now. Alex is unhinged. I think of that night when I called him at almost midnight. I woke him up and he was annoyed because it was the first time in weeks that he'd had a few hours uninterrupted sleep. Until I called, that is. But I'd had that sliver of an idea and it was enough for him to get unstuck. It was the final missing piece of the puzzle. We had the solution. I put all this to him now, through clenched teeth. You don't remember that? Really, Alex?
He smiles from one side of his mouth. The arrogance dripping from his sneer makes me want to slap him.
Do you honestly believe you made that much difference? You're not that good, Anna. It's you who is trying to ride on my coattails here, not the other way around. And anyway, I told you, I've thought long and hard about it over the last few weeks and...
Weeks? You've been letting me do all this work on the paper for the last few weeks? He shrugs.
So? Give me an invoice.
Alex, what are you saying? You can't do this!
Get over yourself.
I'm the best thing that's ever happened to your career, even without your name as co-author. You were my advisor. You'll get lots of accolades from that. And your precious university will get its reward just because I was your PhD student. Don't do this. You know it's not fair.
Life isn't fair. Get used to it.
I laugh. I'm finding that out. But then I see his face, and I don't know whether to punch him or beg him. I take a closer look at him. His trembling hands, the spittle in the corners of his mouth, the dilated pupils, his skin so pale it's almost blue. "Have you been sleeping?" I ask, more gently. He snorts.
"I can sleep when this is done."
I cock my head at him. "What did you take, Alex?" I reach out to touch him, and he jerks backwards. "I think I should call someone. We can discuss all that stuff later, but I think you need help. Have you seen your parents recently?"
"Shut up."
He starts to rub his forehead over and over. I move around the table toward him. I just want to hug him, hold him tight until this passes. "I'm worried about you."
"No, you're not. Stay away from me."
"It's okay." But his nose has started to bleed. "Honey, please, look at me. I'm not moving. I'm right here, Alex. What's wrong? I'm not going to hurt you, you know that." But he's backing against the window behind him, his eyes darting around as if searching for escape.
"I've said my piece and I want you to leave. Now!"
"I have to call someone. I have to do it now. He needs an ambulance, but my bag and my phone are in the living room, so I keep talking, holding his gaze as I walk slowly to him. "You can publish alone. I don't care. I really don't. Come on, Alex. Come and sit down with me." I extend my hand to him again, but he just laughs. I come closer, so close I can almost touch him. He raises his arm over his face.
"Leave me alone!"
For a horrible moment, I think he's afraid of me. Then in one motion, he turns, pushes high the sash window, and swings one leg out so that he is sitting astride the windowsill, looking down. I scream for him to stop, but he's already slipped under the top sash, and I am standing with my arms outstretched and a scream garbled in my throat.
"Alex!"
But Alex isn't there anymore. Chapter 5. It's so strange. Unreal. Like a dream. He didn't scream or shout or make a noise. He just disappeared. I want to run to the window, but I can't move. Black dots swirl in front of my eyes, and I put one hand flat on the table to steady myself.
"Alex?"
After a moment, I take a step, then another, until I've reached the window.
"Alex?"
Slowly, I peer down, along the alley that borders the west side of the building. I can't see him. I'm looking, but I can't see him, and for one beautiful moment I think maybe he's playing a joke on me, until I see his bare foot. His body is wedged between the brick wall of the building and a dumpster. A piece of metal has pierced his torso, and anyone can see that he's dead. I clasp my hands over my mouth to stop myself from screaming and drop to the floor, my back against the wall. I have to get help. I crawl to the living room, stumble upright, and snatch up my bag from where I left it on the couch. It's a tanned, soft leather bag with a single shoulder strap, and Lewis had once joked that searching for something in it was like shoving your hand inside a giant mushroom. I think about that now, the giant mushroom, and I don't know what's real anymore. Am I tripping? Did Alex give me something in that coffee and walk out of the apartment? Is this some kind of prank? No, I didn't touch my coffee.
I empty the bag on the floor because that's the quickest way to locate my phone. I snatch it with shaking hands. Then stop. Alex is dead. I'm sure of it. Should I ring the university first? Or should I ring his parents? What will I say to them? I should ring the ambulance. That's it. That's what I need to do. My finger hovers over the first digit. 9. And tell them what exactly? He was going to leave my name off the paper and then he fell out the window. I remember the letter he gave me earlier, lying on the kitchen table. I pick it up with shaking fingers. It's typed on thick, cream-colored stationery. Dear Anna, firstly, I want to thank you for being my thesis advisor and for everything you've done to make me feel welcome at Locke Wideman. I've decided to publish my work alone. That includes the paper based on my thesis. I know that we had discussed you being cited as co-author, but upon further reflection, I have come to the conclusion that there's no reason at all for your name to be included. To be honest, I'm concerned that having you as co-author will lend your contribution more weight than is warranted. I trust you'll understand and respect my position. Please forward any written material in your possession. Below that, he'd added in a handwritten scrawl, like an afterthought, "Sorry, Alex." I put a hand over my eyes. They'll think I did it. Of course they will. They'll read the letter, then they'll say I pushed him in a fit of rage. They won't believe me when I explain that he just jumped. He was there, then he wasn't. Because that's what happened here, isn't it? Will I go to jail? Yes, of course I'll go to jail. Our doctoral students die. We kill them. Or I kill them. That's what they'll say in the newspaper headlines, the blogs, the social media posts, and talkback radio. Killer. And for some insane reason, I think of my mother and I can almost hear the soft click of her tongue, impatient and disappointed. I return to the window slowly, like a cat, listening the entire time. Every sound seems amplified, like I have bionic hearing. Distant traffic, a dog barking, the clanging of a distant hammer in a construction site. No sirens. Yet. Okay. I need to breathe. Focus. I think of my children as I crumple the letter and shove it in my pocket. I wash the cup and wipe it dry with the tea towel before putting it back in its place on the shelf. Not that I'm concerned about prints or DNA, but best not to raise questions about who was there this morning with Alex. In the living room, I'm on my knees as I frantically gather everything I dropped earlier, my heart bouncing around my chest. 2 tampons, a packet of tissues, a long-lost silver pen, makeup, sunglasses, wallet, keys, loose receipts, an unopened packet of mints, an ID pass on a lanyard for a panel I attended at UCLA last year. A throat soother stuck in its wrapper, the sight of which makes me want to burst into tears. I remembered Matteo doing that, sucking on it and changing his mind, putting it back in its wrapper and dropping it in my bag. I shove it all back into my purse and I'm almost hyperventilating as I dart around the room for anything else of mine. Then finally, softly, quietly, I open the front door. I'm about to check the hallway when I hear footsteps coming up the stairs. I push the door closed again, my heart pounding as I hold my breath, praying that it's not his roommate. In my head, I'm already making excuses as to why I'm here, alone, when the footsteps continue past this floor, up another flight, and I let my breath out. On impulse, I grab a light beige beanie from the coat rack and push it down over my ears. Then I put my sunglasses on. I slip out and almost run down the stairs. I only need a minute, less, 30 seconds,
and I'll be outside. But just as I reach the last flight of stairs, someone comes into the building. I hold my breath and keep my head down as I slip past. I catch a flash of dark hair and the glimmer of a silver and purple ring on an index finger. Sorry.